This is Fresh Air. The new novel, Gospel, is an 800-page religious saga that is both satirical and scholarly. It's about a graduate student and a professor who travel around the world in search of the lost gospel of the 13th disciple of Christ. In telling their quest, author Wilton Barnhart tells his own version of the history of religion. He's described the book as a reverent but irreverent look at all the ways religion has unfolded itself over time. Controversial because it packs in every absurdity, every folly from Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. Barnhart says all his historical references are true. Of course, the part he had to completely make up is the text of the Lost Gospel of Matthias, which is interspersed with the story. I wanted to know what gave Barnhart the idea of creating an undiscovered gospel.
There are a number of gospels that have been discovered this century, at the Nag Hammadi digs in 1948, and of course the Dead Sea Scrolls, which precede Christ. 1896, the Gospel of Mary Magdalene was turned up. In 1956, a Gospel of Mark, older than any copy that had ever existed, was found in the Mar Saba Monastery when they were doing some housekeeping. I believe that we will run across a first century gospel in the next few decades, and I wanted to pose that question. When we do actually hear something from the first century, how different will it be from what's in the Bible? Will it upset the fundamental beliefs of Christianity?
What did you want the gospel that you've written for this novel to reveal or to contradict?
I wanted the gospel that I include every other chapter in this book to be an embodiment, really, of everything that went wrong in the first century in the church. My gospel writer is the disciple Matthias. He is the 13th disciple. He's mentioned once and only once in the Bible. He is the trivia question of the disciples. He is the replacement for Judas. And consequently, I don't think he got in on any of the good miracles. I think he was sort of a tag-along. So his view is different from everyone else, and he's terribly concerned with his rank. He's terribly concerned with celibacy. He's very much like Paul and very much like Jerome. He's obsessed with everyone's sex life, and he very much wants to repress women in leadership roles in the church. So I made him the embodiment of all the wrong turns and all the follies of the early church.
Why did you want to make him the embodiment of everything that you felt went wrong with the church?
Because I think, really, in the 21st century, and it's starting now, I mean, this is hardly revolutionary, but a number of theologians, feminist and otherwise, feel like the church has gotten on the wrong track. The biggest arguments at the moment in the modern Catholic Church are, well, should we have celibate priests? Well, it's not scripturally based, this, and it's not even particularly traditional, because there were certainly, all the disciples were married, it says so in the Bible. Should there be women priests? Well, there were women in leadership roles. In fact, really, a study of the early church calls up the big question. Should there be a priest at all? Maybe there should just be sort of a commune of charity with elders and deacons. That's the only early Christian community we can actually for sure say existed from the Bible. So I think all of this is going to be debated, and I sort of want to throw this book into the debate.
Now, as part of your research for your novel Gospel, you traveled around the world, going in search of what?
I was going in search of a plot, actually. What I did was I tried to make the travels that my modern characters who are searching for this gospel traveled. They go from England to Ireland to Italy to Greece to Jerusalem, up the Nile from Egypt to Sudan to Ethiopia. Along the way, they get a tour of the Judeo-Christian and Islamic world, and they see all the strange things. Well, I wanted to do that travel, too. I stayed in monasteries and pretended to be a pilgrim along the way, and I wanted to see what all the different varieties of faith were. I thought, perhaps, at the end of this search, that I might actually arrive at an answer, but instead I've become very much a polytheist. I believe we all have a little piece of the truth. I do believe in God, and I always take great pains to say this is not an atheistic book. It is not an anti-God book, but it is very anti-religious. If you follow my distinction between spirituality and religion, it is quite nasty to organized religion. And at the end of it, I was left with a sense that everybody thinks they're 100% correct, and everybody thinks everyone else is going to hell. And I'm hoping that the reader will close my book, perhaps at the end, with a renewed sense of ecumenical spirit and tolerance for all the different varieties of belief.
Did you feel a little dishonest pretending to be a pilgrim in that kind of context?
Well, no, I am a pilgrim. I was open-minded to it all. I was ready to hear voices, and in fact, I had a very interesting set of traveling companions. I kept wearing them out. I was on the road for 9 months, and another one would fly in, and they would get worn out, and I would put them on the plane, broken and exhausted, and then another one would come in. I was with a Catholic woman and an Anglican friend that I had met at Oxford, and we were doing the monasteries of Egypt, and I was dragging them because they wanted to go see pyramids and things like that. And we went into the cave of the Pope of Alexandria. The Pope, unlike the Vatican's Pope, lives quite simply and lives in a cave two nights out of the week. And we were warned by the guest master who took us down this desert trail that it was, and it was nighttime for this, that it was a very holy place and that we would feel the Holy Spirit. Well, all three of us, stepping inside this cave, were suddenly overwhelmed with this sense of ecstasy. It spread throughout every part of our body. And I guess it shone on our face because by this one flickering candle, the monk turned and said, "Ah, she is here. The Holy Spirit is with us." And my friend from Oxford, who was quite an atheist, was absolutely terrified and ran from the cave. But I'm willing to believe it's all true. I'm willing to believe that the Holy Spirit visited us that night.
What did you see in there?
Well, it was very simple. The Pope had an icon, a very holy icon, and there was a little carpet for himself, and then there was the candle, and that was the extent of his accommodation in there. So I figure he must be quite a holy man indeed. I almost got a chance to meet the Pope of Alexandria. It didn't quite work out, but I did talk to his assistant, or one of his right-hand men, who said that the Antichrist is among us and has been born in America. So I felt a little apologetic, but as you know, throughout the book, I harp on the end times. I mean, with 1999 and the turn of the millennium coming up, I really have some fun with this. Almost every Christian tradition and a number of the Jewish ones believe that the end is near.
Well, what were some of the manifestations you saw of awaiting the millennium?
Well, on Athos, they're very convinced that it's any day now, and I guess they're some of them are arming themselves, figuring that there will be a... It's a little tricky to talk about it because every tradition has a different view on it. The Irish monks at the moment believe the prophecies of Saint Malachi would suggest that with global warming that the world is ending. As the waters rise, that's supposed to be the sign. And the prophecies of Columbkilla, the same way. There's only supposed to be two more popes before the end of the world. So I guess they better get working on it down in the Vatican. And the Egyptians are fairly sure an all-out war with the Muslims is brewing, where the Christian and the Muslim worlds will fight. And it's all very bloody and horrifying what people are predicting. If you go to a place called Dionysiu, which is a monastery on the coast of Mount Athos, you can see frescoes painted in the 1500s that depict the end of the world. I mentioned them in my book. You see mushroom clouds and giant atomic blasts and missiles toppling cities of skyscrapers. And you think, my God, the 1500s, how could this vision have been so clear? And you also have cockroaches and scorpions that are wearing crowns, as if somehow the artist knew that these alone would be able to survive a nuclear blast. Very terrifying.
Hmm. If you're just joining us, my guest is Wilton Barnhart, and he's written a new novel called Gospel. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Novelist Wilton Barnhart is my guest. You write about martyrdom in your novel Gospel, and for instance, you say Lucy is the graduate student who's on this search for
That's
the gospel.
Right. Yeah.
She was taught that back in Roman days, a girl given the choice of either losing her virginity with some good-looking Roman prince or dying through unspeakable torture would take the unspeakable torture.
Yes, this was the message that the Roman Catholic tradition, well, it was before the Protestants separated. This was what the Christian tradition was, and this was the message to women. Mary becomes this, the amazing sort of submissive humiliation of Mary. Mary is rebuked. Mary says, "No, I'm not worthy." All the female role models in the church were this kind of repressed woman who would do as the man man would tell her, the message of the church for women has not been very positive, which is unfortunate because Jesus took women into his ministry. And Jesus as he says of Mary, Lazarus' sister, she has taken the better portion, it shall not be taken from her, when she sat with the men to listen to the lesson. So I don't believe there is very much that Jesus would approve of the church's treatment of women through the years, and this elaborate sort of Mediterranean legends where the only thing a woman could do to pull equal with men was to die, you know, was to die in unspeakable martyrdoms. I have lots of wonderful gore in the book for those who this is the kind of thing people don't believe, but the ascetic women, the convents of Egypt, where they would take a dull blade and split open their skin and introduce maggots into the wound so they would know what a foretaste of death was like. This was true mortification. I mean, this kind of stuff was practiced along with the castration cults and crucifixion cults and people who would stop strangers on the street and begged to be killed by them. I mean, just incredible, strange things in Christian history.
Your new book is Gospel. You've been on the road on a book tour for the past few weeks.
Past few months.
Okay. Now, while you've been on this tour, the Waco story came to an end. The story of the compound anyways.
Yeah, exactly.
Came to its climax. How did that fit into your story? I mean, here you are following not only the history of Christianity, but the history of cults based on Christianity.
Christianity has always had a propensity for the cult, for the extreme. When you think about this country particularly, we were founded, if you really are serious about it, we were founded very much by cultists. The people who lost the Civil War in England, the Puritans who had broken off with the church, the Congregationalists, later the Methodists, later the Amish, later the Moravians. These early groups were considered, in many cases, heretical, in many cases, unsettling, and were persecuted. They're persecuted for the reasons that all sort of different movements are persecuted. And the Mormons, I mean, there's an example of a cult that has continued and has flourished in Utah. Although, you know, it didn't help Joseph Smith, who was lynched, the founder of the cult. He claimed special revelation, like Koresh claimed special revelation. It's not possible. Wherever there is Christianity, there are these cults. Many times, they're within the context of the organized church. If you go down to Calabria, you see the flagellation festival, where the people beat themselves bloody in the street. I suspect there's some pagan origin to this that precedes Christianity, but the church decides to sort of turn a blind eye and say, well, as long as this is done in the name of the church, this is all right. I live in New Orleans where we have Mardi Gras. Now, there could not be a more irreligious, pagan bacchanal, you know, celebrated. Maybe Rio, you know, and their carnival is the same way. But the church calls it a holy festival, and therefore it precedes Ash Wednesday, after all, and it is sort of incorporated into the church. But all of these things are evidence of a sort of a cultish, pagan underpinning. I've always felt that the United States is particularly ripe for cults. And the reason I feel that way is we don't have a very deep or very ancient culture. If you're born in a place like Naples, where your dialect of Italian is Neapolitan, where your food is Neapolitan, where the tradition of opera, the tradition of dress, everything about your life is so much that, you would never look up like an American could look up and say, I don't know who I am. I don't know what I believe. I don't know who I really am inside. But you could in this country because of the way we move about, because of the fact that we're a fairly modern, progressive, Northern European-based country. And I think people are lost, and I think people have these spiritual searches.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Wilton Barnhart is the author of the new novel, Gospel. This is Fresh Air.